Did that one-day strike last week by Sacramento teachers bring the two sides closer to a continuing contract? Might the Rail Yard Soccer Stadium deal land the region an MLS expansion team? On Insight, those questions and much more for Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg. He joins me in the studio for an extended conversation. Back in 2017, the mayor helped negotiate a new contract for the teachers. It seems to have fallen apart last Thursday when there was a one-day strike. So now what? In our second half hour, meet California's new and first ever Surgeon General. She is Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris. We've posted a link to her TED Talk about her research into the impact of childhood trauma. And that's a topic we're going to spend some time exploring with her today. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's coming up on Insight. Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Think of the program today as a town square. The mayor of Sacramento is here to talk about the teacher strike and much more. Then the new Surgeon General of California will stop by. She will introduce herself and we'll talk about this new job and some of the focus of her career in the medical field. It's all happening over the next hour. Let's begin with Mayor Daryl Steinberg, who is in the studio now. I always appreciate you making time for us. Welcome back.
Good morning, Beth. Great to be with you.
So let's go back to November 6th, 2017, and that big press conference in which you announced that the Sacramento City Unified School District and its teachers had reached a new three-year deal. It was a relief, you said at the time, that a strike had been averted. Was that contract in place for a while?
The contract is in place, and yes, in November of 2017, we averted a strike. What happened after that was that the county superintendent reported to the school board and to the community that the district had a long-term structural deficit. And so over the last year plus, the district and the union, especially the teachers union, have been arguing about the import of the contract and the subsequent declaration by the county superintendent that the district had a deficit. And so here we are today. And I hope that the parties, even with all the emotion, sit back down at the negotiating table and work this out, because there is so much at stake, especially for our kids. This is a high poverty district, and it must be a high performing district. And the only way that can happen is if there is stability in leadership and better relationships between the key stakeholders, none more important than the district board and superintendent and its teachers union. And that has not happened. There is a substantive disagreement. I have my own ideas about how it could be resolved.
In fact, you offered to get involved this time around again in negotiations.
I did, and that offer has not been taken up, and that's okay.
Can I just pause about
yes.
why it hasn't been? I think it has to do with the fact that the superintendent was called out in social media and some mainstream media, and then you issued a statement back saying to the superintendent, Jorge Aguilar, I've got your back.
I did.
So it seems this had gotten quite ugly behind the scenes.
It had. Well, the union called for an extensive investigation of the superintendent. And I felt, as mayor of this city, look, I've been a longtime friend of teachers and the labor movement, but right is right. And I felt that calling for an investigation of the superintendent in the midst of this dispute with so much at stake, and frankly, with the district on the verge of state receivership, which would be the worst outcome possible, I thought it was at best a distraction and did not help. And so, yes, I stated my piece. I still believe that there is a negotiated solution to be had. The dispute here is over the import of health benefits. What the district says is that in order to avoid receivership, which, by the way, would be horrible for the district, its teachers, and its kids, because we would lose all control, expensive loans from the state, and it would take 20 years to dig out of that.
Is that unprecedented?
It is not unprecedented. There have been several other districts that have gone into receivership, and they've never really recovered. And so here's the issue. It's a $35 million deficit.
Right.
The district has some expensive health benefits. They say, we need some relief to the tune of $15 or $16 million as part of an overall solution, needs to include deeper administrative cuts and at least temporary cuts to program. But they need those health benefit savings to avoid state receivership. And that's what must come first. Now, there's a solution here.
But the teachers say those health benefits.
The teachers say that there was an agreement back in 2017 that said any health benefit savings would go into improving the schools, to adding teachers, to reducing class size. How do you reconcile this? I think there is a way. What you do is you say those health benefit savings need to be used to avoid receivership first. And then you find other savings over the course of time. For example, special education in the district, those costs have spiraled to the tens of millions of dollars. If the parties can work together and change this negative relationship and actually find savings for in areas like special education, they can then convert those healthcare savings over time to investing in class size reduction and more counselors and more librarians and more art and the things that the kids in the district so desperately needs. There is an answer here. If there's a little bit of good faith and goodwill and a recognition that the worst thing would be state receivership.
I called this a town square hour, but maybe I should have labeled it the negotiating table, because I think you just put out your solution. And part of why I think you did that is you've sort of been politely declined in your offer to help negotiate. And do you think it has to do with the fact that you backed the superintendent?
Yes. No, the union, it was very clear, despite good relationship over many years and the fact that I helped avoid the strike in 2017, they were mad at me because I spoke my truth, which is that I thought it was not right to attack the superintendent. And I absolutely believe that leadership stability is essential for this high poverty district to become a high achieving district. And Jorge Aguilar came in to this district, yes, without the experience as a superintendent, but with a fierce commitment to equity and with a plan to try to raise student achievement. The parties have to work together. The teachers' union is very important. And the teachers, of course, are the key to the kingdom. They are on the front line of everything involving the schools. But this dysfunction needs to end. The only answer is a ceasefire, a negotiation to work out how to deal with these health benefits in a way that first addresses the deficit to avoid receivership, and then ultimately invest those health benefit savings into the thing that everybody wants, which is more investment in our schools.
Are you being kept in the loop? Are negotiations happening this week during spring break?
I don't know. I am, you know, of course, mayor of the city. I try to be on top of everything, and I am in the loop, so to speak. But I don't think they've moved to that next step from the one-day strike to actually getting serious about negotiating. I think, you know, the district, I think, is willing to sit down. The union is so important. They have so much power, and they represent the most important stakeholders when it comes to student success, the teachers. But the math is the math, and it's a $35 million deficit. And if it is not addressed through a combination of administrative cuts, program cuts, and these health benefit savings, the consequences for everybody is going to be worse. We can do better than this in Sacramento. And so I'm going to keep speaking my mind. I'm not going to disparage or demean anybody. I'm just going to continue to call for a solution and offer my substantive ideas every opportunity I get.
You are listening to Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg. I want to go into what I call sometimes with you somewhat of a lightning round here.
Lightning round.
We have a lot of questions
Keep
to get
it short.
Through.
Okay.
Are you taking an important trip to Los Angeles this week? What am I talking about, and is it a yes or a no?
Well, what you're talking about is the Major League Soccer Board of Governors are meeting in Los Angeles, we believe, to consider Sacramento's strongest of strong bids to become the next Major League Soccer city. There is not a presentation that we've been invited to make, neither the private ownership nor me. So I probably won't go to L.A., but we are in touch with the league. And look, here's the thing. Last week, the Sacramento City Council unanimously made a decision to make a very modest investment in infrastructure in the rail yards. And in return, we are now at the front of the line for Major League Soccer.
Ahead of St. Louis?
Well, I think so, but we will see. We have done everything that the league has asked and more. We have found that investor with the capacity to give the league comfort that we're in this for the long haul. We have great local ownership group, the fan base, the best stadium plan in the country, and now a modest public contribution to the infrastructure. We're ready to go. And, you know, you can only control what's within your control, but I feel really good about it. And we will see over the next couple of days. All the signs are good. And I'll tell you this, Sacramento deserves this. We've worked hard for it, and I'm very hopeful.
Couple yes or no questions. Is Ron Burkle, that big investor, the private investor,
going to
the meeting on Thursday?
I don't believe so.
Okay. Is there a vote Thursday?
We don't know, because we know that they are meeting and we know that this is going to be a subject of discussion, but we don't know whether or not there will be a vote.
Do you know the details of St. Louis's bid?
I know from what I have read, and, you know, St. Louis is a great city, a great baseball town, and I think they put together a strong bid. But our bid is as strong or stronger than theirs. And look, here's the bottom line. In given back to 2017, the league laid out a checklist for us.
Right.
Do these following things, and you're likely to get a team. We've done that. Now it's in their court.
All right. Modest investment. You use that phrase two times at least.
$33 million for a $1 billion return. Because remember, it's more than the stadium. It's the development of the rail yards, which have sat vacant for 40 plus years. And this is a big deal.
You have been a leader in this city for a long time, even when you weren't mayor. And you know there are people who want no public investment in soccer because of housing issues, homeless issues, arts programs, many, many more. In your view, is this the same group of people who opposed the Kings, the downtown arena development?
Largely. I think that's true, and it's philosophical, and I respect that point of view. I just disagree with it. To me, anytime we get into an either-or in our city, then we're falling behind. We need economic development. We need economic drivers. We need things that are going to attract more people to the city, so we build that economic base. At the same time, of course, I'm just as fierce as you know. I've been on your show many times about homelessness, about housing, about economic equity. I gave my State of the City address in Meadowview. We're now launching the Measure U implementation plan with a focus on economic equity. So my message is, this is a city that deserves it all. And yes, it's not perfect, but if we can make a modest investment in attracting a major asset to the rail yards in Sacramento for $1 billion investment in return, it's well worth it.
About housing, what are your observations about the development of downtown, what's happening with the movement of housing, and the huge deficit that we're in right now?
We have a lot of work to do on the housing front, and certainly on the affordable housing front, because what I insist we does not happen in Sacramento is that we make this a city for some with all the great cosmopolitan amenities while leaving many of our neighborhoods and our people out. And housing is a key piece of that. Let me talk about Measure U for just
I want to shift you to the Sacramento Renter Protection and Community Stabilization Charter Amendment. It's qualified now for the ballot. I think on the show that you have previously called it a threat. So now that it has qualified, I wonder whether you think voters should be allowed to vote on this, meaning should voters decide rent control?
Well, certainly voters should always have a say. What I am hopeful is that just like in the teachers, with the teachers issue we talked about a moment ago, that the main stakeholders and the policymakers will sit down between now and November of 2020 and actually come to a resolution that does not create rent control across the board in Sacramento, because I think that would be a mistake. I think it would harm the drive to build more affordable housing, and at the same time, to recognize that there are too many people suffering, and where rents are increased in a way that constitutes gouging, that there ought to be some protection for people. Now, a couple of my colleagues have come forward with a plan that's going to come before the council next week calling for long-term leases and mandatory mediation. I know a lot of the advocates don't like it. I think that there are a lot of positive elements in that. And we'll debate it. And the question will be, is it enough? I'm not sure it is enough, but I think you've got to start. I tried, as you know, again, to negotiate temporary rent caps on older buildings. The stakeholders, especially on the business side, did not like that. And yet this initiative is looming. And I think the initiative itself has some problems because it's rent control across the board, calls for an elected rent board. There are elements of this I really don't like. And so is there an opportunity, again, to sit down and work together to both continue the incentive to build more and at the same time protect vulnerable people? Because, by the way, there's a big relationship between the housing crisis and our increase in homelessness, because who do you think ends up in many cases in our shelters and on the street? So this is another one of those grind them out. I think my three colleagues come forward with a proposal that is a step in the right direction, and we're going to need to continue to work on this.
Am I hearing between the lines here that you hope some solution will get us to the point where that ballot measure is not actually on the ballot?
Exactly. I always hope for a negotiated solution, because it's always better than a 100% up or down.
A quick answer. Is your appointment to chair the Governor's Commission on Homelessness some of a bigger statewide effort to converge what you just said, housing and homelessness?
I think so. I mean, the governor and I and the administration are working hard on putting this task force together. I hope that he will make some announcements in the next days or week and that we're going to get going. But, you know, this is not just a Sacramento problem. It's a statewide problem. And my fundamental belief, and the governor has been very refreshing in that he has made housing and homelessness an actual priority, both budget-wise and policy-wise. They're complicated issues, but we do not have to accept this homelessness condition throughout our state. We need a greater sense of urgency. We need to treat this like the public health and public safety and humanitarian crisis that it is. We need to take the practices that we know actually get people off the street and prevent people from becoming homeless, and we need to create them to scale. We may not cure it, but we can make it much better.
You are listening to Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg. I am going to let everybody know that before you came in here, you hinted at an announcement that's coming that I think you used the phrase, perhaps the biggest announcement of your mayorship.
Well,
in Sacramento.
Did I say that? I don't know. I don't want to get ahead of myself.
That's
but
what I heard.
I do want to say, so the April, you know, I think it's a very important month. Hopefully we get Major League Soccer. And then later in the month, I'm going to tease a little bit. We're going to make a big announcement about Sacramento's waterfront, because this is another one I looked at when I ran for mayor and said, we are at the confluence of two rivers. We've got this natural asset, and we've done so little with it. And it's time that changes.
So
and I
more
think
of a hint, then?
We change with Old Sacramento.
Okay.
Instead of just putting forward pretty pictures and plans, we've actually found a creative way to gather tens of millions of public dollars through our hotel tax and to actually put forward a dynamic plan to transform first stage of our Sacramento riverfront. So I'll leave it at that later in the month. But, you know, it's another example of how I think in this city, we cannot do either or. We have to focus on the big picture economic development opportunities, the waterfront, soccer, more industry like Centene. And at the same time, we build that tax base and we invest those Measure U resources in building an arts culture, in investing in our neighborhoods, in affordable housing. And none of it's perfect, but we're moving in the right direction.
You just cued the next topic when you said the word arts. So let's talk about the city's arts budget, the Creative Edge grant process.
Yes.
We are hearing frustration about it. We're hearing concern that the city manager isn't going to allocate enough funding for the Creative Edge program. Are you hearing the same complaints and concerns?
I am hearing the same complaints. And look, we have a great city manager who's doing his job. He's putting forward, you know, a budget. But then it shifts to the city council. We're the ones with the power and authority to pass a budget. That's exactly what we're going to do. And I am absolutely committed to building and funding arts as a main strategy for what I call inclusive economic development. Because arts is every bit as important as sports, you know? We talk about soccer.
Can you put this in numbers? What kind of millions in baseline funding?
Well, I don't know yet. Okay. But certainly one of the things we have been talking about for a long time, if you go back to my State of the City address back in 2018, I talked about using some of the Measure U money as a repayment source for what I call a capital equity fund. Right, to use some of the ongoing money to actually create capital. If we have hundreds of millions of dollars worth of capital, we can both create a housing trust fund and an arts endowment. Why not? We can do big things here. We don't have to think about $500,000 at a time or $1 million at a time.
Is the city manager in that thinking with you?
The city manager is a partner, and we have different jobs. And, you know, let's be clear about
one. That sounds like sort of a no.
No, it's not a no.
Okay.
We just have different jobs. His job is to run the government. My job is to help run the government, but also lead the city towards new directions. And here's one of this is the fundamental issue. I've got a minute here. There's a debate in the city. Some would say that the city's mission is to fund core services, especially public safety services. And that's a legitimate point of view. My point of view is that plus. I have a different point of view. I did this half cent for Measure U, this additional half cent, specifically on the promise that we would invest most or all of these resources in building a modern, inclusive economy. Now we won. And now the debate begins, because victory has 1,000 fathers, as they say. And now that we have the money, everybody wants their share of it. Well, I intend to stick by what I promised the voters. And of course, it's up to the community and my fellow city council members. But I want to invest the lion's share of this money into building a broader tax base, into building a creative economy, into addressing our housing crisis, into investing in Meadowview and in our other neighborhoods that deserve the attention, in our young people. And so how do we do that, especially when you pass one budget at a time and we have significant long-term obligations? This is the challenge, but it's exactly what I put this Measure U initiative forward to stoke and to create new opportunity, new investment. And ultimately, my argument to the public safety unions and others is that if we don't build a broader tax base in this city, we will never be able to sustain the level of public safety services that the people want and deserve.
All of this, Mayor Steinberg, sounds like long-term work. And ballots are going to go out for the next election in about 9 months. Are you planning to run for a second term, in which case you will need a victory of 1,000 mothers, too?
Yes, I will. I'm not going to make an announcement here on the show, although, you know, Beth, I might, when I'm ready to make an announcement, I might come back and just do that with you. But I would say this. I'm enjoying the work. It is very challenging. Every bit as challenging as being president of the Senate, just in a different way. I do think it takes more than 4 years to change the arc of the city in the way that I think the people want, and to be able to make these long-term sustained investments, and to say that our city can become this next great American city while not leaving anyone behind. And I do think it takes more than 4 years to do that. So maybe that's a little bit of a hint, but I'm not ready to make an announcement. I still have to think about it all. But
you have a standing invitation to come back here and make that announcement at any point in time.
Thank you.
And I'm going to keep my promise to let you go to your meeting with one last question. If you do run for re-election, even if you don't, are you up for the fight to change the structure of government in Sacramento? Are you interested in pushing for a strong mayor ballot measure?
That was our last conversation.
It was unfinished, Mayor Steinberg.
It was unfinished. You know, I am open to that question, if not for me, certainly for a future mayor. I do think that the structure should be changed. I think that as great a partnership as I have with the city manager, the structure of government, I think, makes it harder to get things done and to move assertively in the direction of the will of the people under this system. But, you know, I don't know whether I will seek to do that in the near term because I'm so focused on the work itself. And so we're looking at it, and I'll look at it, but it isn't what I wake up every morning to focus on. I'm focused instead on waterfront soccer, homelessness, housing, economic equity, arts, and everything else that the people elected me to do.
Well, thank you. In about 25 minutes, you covered it all today.
We always do.
We'll have a new lineup next time.
Okay.
As I said, I always appreciate the time. We don't take it for granted. Glad you made so much time for us today.
Thank you so much, Beth.
That is Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg. You can find today's conversation posted online, as well as links to our past conversations. It's all at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. California's first Surgeon General is Dr. Nadine Burke Harris. Her work as a pediatrician started with her residency, actually, at Stanford. In 2005, she joined California Pacific Medical Center and founded the Center for Youth Wellness. She has been an advisory council member for Hillary Rodham Clinton's Clinton Foundation's Too Small to Fail campaign. She researches and works in the arena of childhood trauma. She's written a book, given a TED Talk about it, and now we have a chance to meet her and talk about it in person. Dr. Burke Harris is with me in the studio. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning.
Welcome to this new job that you have. And what reactions are you hearing across California to the idea that the state now has a Surgeon General?
It's been overwhelmingly positive. I have gotten so much wonderful welcome from folks all over the state, and it's exciting. Yeah, I think people are excited.
So California, I understand, is the fifth state with a Surgeon General. There is some precedent for how it's being handled. But when you and the governor talked about this role, how was it mapped out for you? What were the expectations that came with this role?
When we had our conversation, the governor was really focused on a couple of things. Number one, addressing health disparities, right? That's the unacceptable level of health disparities across our state. And the governor was also really supportive of deepening and expanding the work around childhood trauma, early childhood health, and also these issues of how we address the ways that early adversity manifest in affecting health throughout the life course. So it was a super fun conversation. It was really about, you know, what can we do in the state of California to help make our residents healthier.
Can you share a little bit more about yourself? How was it that you knew the mayor? How was it that you were able to get his audience and his attention enough that he thought your work merited leading the state?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I actually first met Governor Newsom when he was mayor of San Francisco, and I was working in one of San Francisco's most underserved neighborhoods, Bayview Hunters Point. And he actually came out for the grand opening of the clinic, when we opened a clinic in a medically underserved area of San Francisco. And subsequently, I was appointed to serve on the mayor's Office of Community Investment, and did that as a citizen of San Francisco. But, you know, to be honest, I think in terms of how I ended up coming into the role of Surgeon General, this is hilarious. This is a case of be careful what you wish for, because, you know, as a physician, as a practitioner, and as a health advocate, as Governor Newsom was on the campaign trail, I would, you know, periodically send out emails, you know, to say, hey, this is what other states are doing about adverse childhood experiences. This is how many Californians are affected by adverse childhood experiences and the long-term health issues. This is a public health crisis. Governor, you know, when he was running, what are you going to do about it?
You were emailing him directly.
I was sending to his team.
You didn't know if these were landing in front of him, though.
That's right. And although I did hear back from his policy advisor, and he ran really on a child health, child right. first campaign. And so
he probably put you in the column of go-getters, educated, informed, on the front lines of some of this work.
Yeah, it could be. I'm not sure about what the process was. And certainly I had also, you know, worked with several members of his team in some of the work that I had been doing. So, for example, in my work with Secretary Hillary Clinton, Anne O'Leary, who is now the governor's chief of staff, knew my work through my work with Secretary Clinton as well.
So I want everybody to hold on one hand that you have this sort of backstory relationship connection with the governor when he was mayor. On the other, let's talk about that childhood trauma work. And I think you need to explain adverse childhood experiences and that study. And this is an arena that in medicine is fairly new. The CDC only really started to identify childhood trauma, I believe, in the 1990s.
That's right. Well, childhood trauma is a long known health issue, but much of this work really came to attention after a landmark study that was conducted by Kaiser Permanente and the CDC. It was published in 1998, called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And what they did in that study was they asked about 17,500 adults about their histories of 10 categories of adverse childhood experiences. And those include physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, physical and emotional neglect, or growing up in a household where there was a parent who was incarcerated or substance dependent, or who experienced mental illness, or if there was parental separation or divorce or domestic violence. And what they
so each of those categories is assigned a point.
That's right.
And the score becomes how many points. Obviously, the higher number of points, the higher amount of childhood trauma.
That's right. So it's really a measure of cumulative adversity over childhood. And what they found were two things that were really striking. One was that adverse childhood experiences were incredibly common. So two-thirds of individuals in this study had experienced at least one adverse childhood experience, or ACE, and 1 in 8 folks had experienced 4 or more. And keep in mind, this wasn't the inner city. This wasn't a low-income population. This was Kaiser San Diego, 70% Caucasian, 70% college educated. Mm. So it really recognized that this was much more common than many people previously anticipated or believed. And the other piece was that the higher the number of ACEs, the greater the risk for, again, not just the things that you would expect, like mental health issues like depression, and also behavioral issues like substance dependence and other issues like that, but dramatically increased risk for heart disease, stroke, cancer, chronic lung disease, liver disease, even Alzheimer's. And it was through this landmark study that really ignited a field of research in understanding how adversity in childhood leads to repeated activation of the stress response, which, when it's activated too frequently, can go from being from protecting us, right, from being life-saving to being overactivated and difficult to turn off. And that can lead to long-term problems with our health. And that's what's now known as the toxic stress response.
You're listening to California's first Surgeon General, Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris. And somewhere there was an intersection for you of that topic with your own study and work as a pediatrician. What was the lights on moment about this arena of childhood trauma with where you wanted to dedicate your life and your work?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I was, as I mentioned, working in a very low-income neighborhood of San Francisco, Bayview Hunters Point. This was a neighborhood at the time I opened my practice where violence was the leading cause of early mortality, right? Unlike every other neighborhood in San Francisco where cardiovascular disease was the, or HIV/AIDS were the one and two leading causes of early death. And what I was seeing in my patients and what I was hearing by being this community pediatrician was that my patients were being exposed to many of these ACEs, these adverse childhood experiences, but oftentimes it wasn't being recognized as a health issue. It was being recognized as behavioral problems, that kids got bad behavior. And there wasn't an understanding that because of what many of my patients had experienced, their body's stress response was being overactive, and that was looking like ADHD or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or that was really the root that was affecting their asthma or leading to increased risk of diabetes. And so getting to the root of the root was absolutely critical in being able to improve my patient's health.
In your TED Talk, which you gave in September of 2014, and it was titled How Childhood Trauma Affects Health Across a Lifetime, you said you actually had to throw your training out the window on this and really go through a paradigm shift and look at this in a whole new way. What do you mean by that?
Well, as when I trained, first of all, we didn't learn anything about the Adverse Childhood Experiences study or about the biological mechanisms of toxic stress. And so when if a teacher was referring a child for ADHD or we were seeing a child who, you know, was having severe asthma or something else, I was taught to prescribe that inhaler medication or to prescribe the ADHD medication or, you know, perhaps refer them to a mental health provider if it seemed like it was necessary. And I never learned in my training, wait a minute, if I actually want to improve the health of my patients, I have to address the underlying problem, the root cause, which is the exposure to adversity. And so that is really what I've spent the last decade of my professional career is not only developing clinical protocols and advancing the science and doing the research, but also raising awareness. Step one in addressing this issue is dealing with the fact that no one really knew about it, right? So public health 101 is to raise awareness, because when we learned, hey, you know, cigarettes can kill, secondhand smoke is also really damaging to health, that allowed us to change our practices, right? And that doesn't mean that quitting smoking is easy, right? Or any of these solutions are just, oh, okay, I've got the information. And so, but when we know better, we can do better. And it was really important to arm families and parents and communities with the information to safeguard their kids' health.
Just to understand this in a very simple way, you're saying that kids who have been through trauma exist on sort of this place of continual fight or flight.
That's right.
And which does a lot of things, kicks up cortisol, changes your biochemistry, and so your body is reacting at a higher level. And then the symptoms of that could end up being ADD, ADHD,
asthma, poor growth, diabetes, et cetera. Yeah.
So we have to go back. And in your TED Talk, again, you call this the, here's the quote, single greatest unaddressed public health threat facing our nation today. That's huge.
Yeah, it's big. It's big. I mean, when we think about the fact that two-thirds of our population, so here in California, 61.7% of Californians have experienced at least one adverse childhood experience. And 16.7% of Californians have experienced four or more adverse childhood experiences. And that 16.7% of Californians are at more than double the risk for heart disease, more than 2.5 times the risk for stroke, triple the risk for chronic lung disease. We now understand that early adversity is a root cause of some of our biggest chronic disease issues and our biggest drivers of healthcare costs, right? And not just healthcare costs. When you look at the proportion of, for example, the kids in special ed who have experienced adverse childhood experiences, or individuals in our justice system, or individuals who are experiencing mental health and substance dependence issue. For someone with four or more adverse childhood experiences, they're 10 times as likely to be an IV drug user as someone with zero adverse childhood experiences. The ramifications are everywhere in our society, and we have this incredible opportunity now that we understand the drivers and the science behind it to raise awareness, do early detection and early intervention, and we can change those outcomes.
Now let's merge that early conversation we had about your background with the governor and him putting you in this position with all of the arena where your work has been. You are speaking to and representing an entire state, and the issues are, of course, much broader than childhood trauma. However, the governor's budget does propose $45 million for screening for adverse experiences, not only for children, but for adults as well. You must have been driving the funding so that some work could be happening in that arena. Are you at the stage of building an infrastructure for this yet?
So that's exactly where we are. So first of all, the $45 million that's in the governor's proposed budget is absolutely critical. That is going for reimbursement to providers for screening, right? Because we're asking providers to be on the front lines with doing the early detection.
It's
in clinic. So it's for doctors and nurse practitioners, right? To do this ACE screening. Yes, it's a survey.
Which isn't there now?
Exactly. It's not. It's used in some pioneering practices. For example, the practice that I was running when I mm-hmm. was before I came into this role, and actually there are quite a number of practices around the state that are starting to do it. But this is AB 340, Assembly Bill 340, that was passed into law, now requires that all primary care clinicians screen their patients, children and adults, for adverse childhood experiences for patients who are on public insurance, so receiving Medicaid.
How do you reach people, by the way, who don't have a provider, who aren't insured, people who might also be those most vulnerable or certainly fit in some ways this category?
Well, that's exactly, I think, one of the things that the governor and the administration is really taking on and tackling really strongly. Because this reimbursement for providers is just one part of the issue, right? One part of the solution. The other part of the solution is that the administration is working really hard to strengthen the attacks on the Affordable Care Act, right? And to support health for all, right? That is really what the governor has been pushing towards, is having, making sure that we can get every Californian with access to health insurance.
So let's broaden this to your role as Surgeon General and what for you are specific goals and priorities, assuming that work is going to be made in this arena of the childhood trauma. What else? Where do you have to focus your attention? And what's the expectation in terms of health care in the state?
Yeah, so my big focus, really I'm focused on three things. And I want to say that when we think about surgeons general who have really accomplished a lot, I mean, everyone thinks iconic surgeon general, C. Everett Koop.
Mm-hmm.
And we really think about the bold work that he did on smoking. On HIV/AIDS. And part of the reason for that is, as Surgeon General, I feel like it is a big part of my job is not just to remind folks of the things that we know that they need to do to stay healthy, but also to help folks understand what is the public health crisis that they didn't know existed. Right. And that is real, and bring that to the surface and align our resources into really being able to address it on a public health level. And really, in when you look at it through that lens, I'm very much focused on tackling a couple of issues. I don't have any intention to boil the ocean, but I'm really going to be focused on child health and well-being, particularly focused on adverse childhood experiences, developmental screening, and a lot of the early foundations for health. Also, the science of toxic stress. You heard me say that we see, double the risk for heart disease, 2.5 times the risk for stroke. But the science behind that, understanding how any physician or clinician in California should perhaps be treating their patients differently if they have an ACE score of 8 versus if they have an ACE score of 0. Mm-hmm. That science has a tremendous way to go. And that's not just a child health issue. Most of the manifestations that we see in terms of chronic disease really show up in adulthood. So really advancing that science. And my other really key focus is going to be on health equity. We are the fifth largest economy in the world, and yet we still have unacceptable levels of inequities in health outcomes. When we look at, for example, maternal mortality, we see that African American mothers are dying at a rate that is greater than 4 times that of Caucasian mothers in the state of California today. That's unacceptable. So really pushing on these issues of child well-being, toxic stress, and health inequities are really the areas that it will be my focus.
You have been in the midst of a listening tour going across the state. So is the picture of the health and healthcare reality of Californians different in any way from the smaller world that you were in, even though San Francisco itself isn't a small world, but Bayview, Hunters Point and beyond? Did that mirror the rest of the state, or have there been surprises?
To be honest, I would say the things that I hear over and over again as I'm going around on the listening tour are surprisingly similar. They are families and communities and organizations and providers really struggling, who feel like they're in the trenches, oftentimes, especially when it comes to the issue of childhood adversity and addressing the long-term outcomes of that. They often feel like, this is what I'm doing, but I feel overwhelmed. And I'm a doctor, and I may be screening for adverse childhood experiences in my practice, but I'm not with these kids all day, and it feels like what they need is more than what I can provide. And then educators saying, hey, you know what? We see these kids in our classrooms, and we're doing our best to provide trauma-sensitive and trauma-informed educational practices, but we don't feel like we're not doctors. We don't have the resources to give them everything that they need. And so on and so forth, right? And we see, and what I am hearing is that we don't all need to do everything, But what I see is that these connections and understanding how we can coordinate across sectors to be able to drive towards reduction of poor outcomes, that's the piece that really, I think, needs attention, is this coordination.
What's your vision for where this topic goes? Could you foresee a day when prenatal care involves education about these ACE categories in childhood trauma?
Absolutely. In fact, that's already happening in Richmond, California. Kaiser Richmond already did a pilot on screening for ACEs in the prenatal, as part of regular prenatal care. I think that the issue of early adversity and how it affects health, right, and really from a scientific and a biological standpoint, for me, very much, it's a little bit like germ theory. When we realize that infections are actually caused by microbes and not by foul airs, it completely changed the way that we responded. And some of those changes were hand washing. Right? Some of those changes were sanitizing our water or pasteurizing milk. And other of those changes were sophisticated, you know, third and fourth generation antibiotics. Where we are now in understanding how early adversity affects health and development across the lifetime, we can begin with a hand washing stage. We can start with simply screening, early identification, and early intervention. And then we can get much more sophisticated as time goes on. But for now, right, there's no wrong place to start.
I think you're saying that someday there's going to be a tipping point.
Absolutely. And I hope that that day is coming sooner than many of us would anticipate. For me, in my mind, it's as clear as day that we are coming towards that tipping point, and California is leading the way.
Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, she is California's new Surgeon General. Very quick final question. A year from now, when you'll have had a year as Surgeon General, what do you hope you might have either accomplished or understood better than you do right now?
Well, I'm hoping to understand some of the resources. This is my first time working in government, so I'm still navigating, understand how does everything work and what are the resources that we can deploy towards these outcomes. And I hope to have, by the end of a year, maybe a little longer, maybe it's a year and a half, a Surgeon General's report on adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress in the state of California.
Thank you so much for your time, for being here in our studio. I know this will be an ongoing conversation, and I look forward to you joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, and we'll post a link to her TED Talk and more information about her work. That's at capradio.org/insight. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. I'm on Twitter at @CapRadioRuyak. We're back tomorrow with another live show. Thanks for joining us.